We sing in favor of something new. We love comparing the old and new. To tell the tale of a brave Time Lord, we'll keep on coming back till you're born. There is no glory greater than the download of a podcast fan. No Patreon on earth for we, just a perpetual hosting fee.
Welcome to the podcast where we take something old, a Doctor Who story from the original series, compare it with something new, one from the new series, and add something borrowed, that song, to make Something Who. Hello, I'm Richard, and we're back with Something Who podcast episode 93, where this time we're looking at two stories where technology turns up unexpectedly in a historical setting. We'll look at Fifth Doctor story, The King's Demons, from Season 20, and after that we'll examine 12th Doctor outing, The Girl Who Died, from Series 9. And with me to decide whether these stories are medieval magic or just a little bit tragic, I have with me the two regular co-hosts of Something Who, starting with our very own Sir Gilles. So, hello, Giles.
Hello.
I hope you found plenty in these stories to satisfy your appetite for authentic science.
Oh dear, yes, definitely.
Can you not do it in an authentic French accent for us?
You've caught me out by introducing me that way. I'm now floundering, trying to think.
Just say Blue Engine or whatever it was. Yeah.
the Blue Engine.
Very good. And we also have our very own literary critic. So hello, Paul. And I'm sure there's plenty of cod Shakespeare and gags for you to get your teeth into.
Oh, we can hope so. Yes. Good evening, Paul.
So before we get into the two stories, we've had a trailer for the new series. Either of you seen it? Any thoughts about that?
I watched it 5 minutes ago because I suddenly remembered I hadn't. And it was pointed out to me that you might ask. So I watched it. But I haven't really got anything to say about it. It's a trailer, you know. It's all little short bits, and I don't. It didn't mean anything to me.
Yeah.
Sorry. It looks quite exciting, but that's the job of a trailer, isn't it?
Yeah, I have had a similar thought. Giles, any insight from you?
Not hugely. I guess it's. I mean, it's definitely it's a trailer made for the new
trailer made
markets with.
Trailer tailor made.
It's clearly a trailer made to attract new viewers.
Yeah,
indeed.
Start here. What with the Bowie and all of that stuff. It's got a bit of a different vibe from what we've had in the past.
They should have resurrected the old Run for Your Life from the glory days of 2005.
Oh yes, yeah.
Run for Your Life. That got all the kids excited.
Yeah. Enough in there to look like there's something interesting going on, hopefully, underneath all the fun. Yeah. But you know what I mean.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Kind of stuff we watch it for.
Yeah.
And dinosaurs.
Oh, well, now, hang on. There is something to say about it. Sorry. Of course, somebody says there's supernaturalism everywhere. Everything's getting more supernatural. Or did they say the universe is getting more supernatural, which, of course, is continuing the theme that... Mm. Some people saw coming in Wild Blue Yonder and was developed in the subsequent two episodes. And now it's becoming explicit in the text. So.
Well, I mean, the line at the end is, when you can change time, anything is possible. Which, again, I don't know, that sounds a bit Superman to me. Yeah, the end. Yeah. I don't know if we're going to be doing that. Mind you, I mean, we were always doing that in the Moffat era, weren't we? Going back and correcting stuff that he didn't like, or creating stuff that he deliberately wanted to then go back and correct.
True.
Who knows?
Mm.
The closest Doctor Who's ever got to the end of of Superman the movie is, oddly enough, Doctor Who the movie.
Oh, yes, that's very true. Mm. Very true.
with its misunderstanding of the way time works. It's second only to Superman the movie, where they spin a planet backwards to change time. But I mean, resurrecting people by turning time backwards like it's the dial on your oven, it was almost as inept. I don't imagine that's where we're going. But who knows? I've been wrong before.
And most importantly, will he be staying up till midnight to watch it?
No. I'm very old now. I'm not saying I don't ever stay up till midnight, but if I do, it will be on my terms.
Yes. Yeah.
And for some reason, less productive than watching Doctor Who on iPlayer.
Yeah, they picked the wrong person to get upset about that, because I don't think I've watched Doctor Who live in a very long time. Actually, there was one exception. I did watch The Giggle live, but I think everything else I've seen, you know, at least several hours late, if not a couple of days late. Yeah. But I know it has got some people in a tizzy. I mean, I guess we're experiencing what Australia's had to put up with for the last however long.
No, I will watch it live. I'll just watch it live at 7 o'clock on the Saturday.
I don't take it too lightly. I think it is unfortunate that people have to avoid spoilers.
Yeah.
I've seen people some thoughtless people being extremely obnoxious on this subject on the Twitter, saying, you know, telling young people to keep, people who care, to keep off the internet for the next day or whatever. It's a bit much in this day and age. So,
yeah. Well, there's no question. If I was 15, I'd be incensed. Yeah.
Were you an angry young
15,
man?
15, you'd be staying up till midnight.
Probably.
Without some...
Yeah, that too.
I know, so there's probably a Venn diagram of the people who will have difficulty staying away from social media for until they get their opportunity to watch it in their own time on Saturday, and the people who can also probably have the vim and vigour to stay up and watch it straight away, I would imagine. But I don't know. I don't want to be one of those people that makes a fuss about it, because I'm aware it's just the reality of the modern world, but in general I don't really approve of any of this stuff where they like release dump the thing onto streaming at midnight on the day of when the premiere is going to be in the evening. I don't approve of like release the whole thing in one go after the first episode has been on TV. I feel it dilutes the communal experience, but then it's the way of the world, isn't it?
Well, there aren't many programs where it's as hard to avoid spoilers as Doctor Who. People just take a joy in talking about it and showing off that they've seen it
as
soon as possible. And as far as I'm vaguely aware, that even the BBC do that, that people are upset that as soon as in the recent ones, as soon as the episode had finished, they would put up photographic spoilers of these things on Twitter, so you literally couldn't avoid it.
Yeah.
So I assume they're going to have to rein that in. Unless they're not actually going to. But when will they wait? Will they wait to the on air? The what do we call it?
The live broadcast.
The live broadcast. Yes.
Because Britain's the only place that's going to be doing it, isn't it?
They're going to put it on iPlayer, but pretend it's not there until 6 o'clock the following evening, and then talk about it publicly.
I can't imagine it happening that way. But it would be nice if it did.
Yeah. Well, let's wait and see.
Yeah.
But at least these press releases that should give away all the spoilers early won't be written by AI. We won a minor victory there, whoever we are, whatever the victory was.
Yeah, yeah. I remember being absolutely furious about the Five Doctors premiering first in the US in 1983, when I was 15, interestingly. So, yeah, I suppose that's what I would be like if I was still 15, but I'm not.
I'm sure we've discussed this. Yeah.
No, I agree with all of you, the points you've made. Sorry, go on.
I'm sure we discussed this before. Didn't they release the novel of the Five Doctors first?
Yes, they did.
So you had.
Yes.
It was there was a multi-pronged a pincer attack on us willpower back then.
Yeah.
It was difficult to find out any spoilers from America because it would have taken them more than 2 days to get here.
Yeah.
Because there was no internet.
There were phones, but you'd have needed to know somebody in America, wouldn't you?
Don't lie to our younger listeners. There were no phones. The post took about a week, I seem to remember. You could send a train to Albatross for the news. That's probably the fastest way back then, but it was a very different world.
You could go faster than sound, though, across the Atlantic, which you can't do anymore.
I could, yeah. Mm. Well remembered.
Mm.
Or if you were Superman, you could just send the planet backwards and watch it.
Yeah. Didn't Elton John Charles of Concord in order to watch Five Doctors live in the same place. I'm getting that mixed up with that, yeah.
Almost certainly. If it wasn't him, it would have been Mike Gatting.
if we're talking about new news, I gather Russell has shocked the world by telling us that there won't be a 20th anniversary special or any celebration at all for the new series.
Right.
I don't think that's a massive surprise. As he quite fairly points out, it will be following on hard nails of a 60th anniversary and a 100th anniversary.
Yes.
Hmm.
And I suppose the main point is, if you're going to do anniversaries, which he's not keen on anyway, you would really have to pick a side, the old series or the new series.
Yes.
If you're going to celebrate the 60th, you can't do...
Yeah,
anniversary, the 60th anniversary of the original series. You can't celebrate the new series as well, because otherwise they would be popping up at ridiculously frequent intervals.
Mm.
So,
and also, I mean, he's essentially called this a third version, hasn't he? It's the new series.
He has a bit. Yeah. Mm. And where do we measure that from?
Mm. Well, it's a good question.
2023, because the series itself starts this year, but...
Oh, yes. Oh, Colin, that's confusing as well, yeah.
Well, maybe it's the fourth iteration. Maybe those four specials last year were a completely separate...
Yeah.
Mm.
Of themselves. Well...
Doesn't bother me as...
Yeah.
As it were.
It bothers me as much as it would my 15-year-old self. He's very angry, Richard. a bit like yours.
Yeah.
Do you know why my 15-year-old self was so angry?
Why was your 15-year-old self so angry?
It was because Terror of the Vervoids episode 1 was broadcast on my 15th birthday, and he'd just watched it.
Right.
So what more excuse do you need? That ruined the entire year for me.
Right.
I didn't come down off the ceiling for 12 months.
You didn't like Agatha Christie in space, because it wasn't, I suppose.
Every story that is considered to be a murder, an authentic Christie-style murder mystery, is not, including Black Orchid. So is that just back on track?
Yeah.
Because I'm going to be having something to say about that story's author.
Very good.
It's the people like Shannon Sullivan who still are desperately trying to keep track of what season we were on in the in old school counting, original counting. I got completely thrown. By looking through his website earlier and doing a bit of research and finding season 35, it turns out, is
where this one is.
Is where this one is, yeah. God knows what we're up to now.
Yeah. About 40, I suppose.
Mm.
Okay, so The King's Demons, written by the aforementioned Terence Studley, well, sort of.
Terence Studley.
And directed by Tony Virgo.
The
snooker player, not John Virgo, and broadcast on the 15th and 16th of March 1983, when I was, funnily enough, 15. In a break with tradition, I watched this incessantly in my teens. This was one of the ones that I videoed.
I watched it not incandescently.
incessantly. I even wrote a novelization of it, because it was one of the ones that didn't come out on Target all that early. I mean, it was early-ish, it was 86, but that was about 3 years. So I thought, I'll write my own novelization then. It was no good. I mean, you know, don't ask me to get it out of the loft. But that necessitated an awful lot of pausing and rewinding the tape. And as a result, I'm not sure that I've seen it since the 80s.
Right. But if you watched it that much, did it linger in your memory?
Yes.
Oh, very interesting.
I remembered much when I watched it this morning.
I'm going to have to go second, because I have something to say about it. How very odd. Have we discussed this before? I won't put too fine a point on this. I made an abortive attempt to write a novelisation of this as well.
Oh, right.
Did we all? Yeah.
No, I didn't.
I recorded episode 1.
Right.
Was that the first episode I taped? No, it wouldn't have been. I taped it. Or was it? Might have been. I recorded episode 1 and started and thought, how hard can it be? And started trying to write it up, and I was unhappy with my progress. So it didn't get very far. But how peculiar that we both picked this. And I don't think it was because Target were lax in releasing their own version, and I just couldn't bear to be without it. I don't think it was that. We had a very bad reception at our house. The transmitter was across a hill and there was a valley, and we could barely pick out the picture. And so a lot of my recordings from the 80s are almost unwatchable.
Mm.
Not just the fuzzy picture, the snow on the picture, but the sound is all wobbly. So when I I watch it, so I watched that episode quite a lot because I had it, but when I watch it now, I hear the distorted, wobbly soundtrack from 1983 in my head.
That's just Gerald's head.
The song in particular, some very strange key changes in my mind. The real one doesn't. That's a very boring anecdote, but I just thought I'd share it with you.
Yeah.
So.
One of them there are things the kids these days don't have to put up with.
Mm. Yeah. Can you imagine?
Mm. It's funny you mentioning that. I have some vague recollection, but I may now just be attaching that to this. But I have some vague recollection of doing my nuts when the signal just drops out for a couple of minutes. And I'm vaguely thinking, was it in this? But I don't know. It would have been around this time,
right?
Yeah, it's weird. My abortive creative efforts went no further than a sort of stage adaptation of The Invisible Enemy. And a sequel to Time Flight of some sort.
Oh.
How old were you when you did the stage adaptation of Invisible Enemy?
Probably around the same time. Never performed.
What a shame.
Yeah, or possibly just circulated to the family. Say to my grand, you'll be Professor Marius. Yeah, no, it's weird. It's this one, I was saying to you guys earlier, it's odd that this one seems to have stuck in my head as well a lot. And it would have been one of those ones I'd have probably have, I think, taped on my little Philips Cube black and white telly with a integrated tape recorder.
Right.
And played to death. And being a two-parser, it probably meant I was able to record it on a C60.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was inherently less likely to get garbled with with repeated playbacks, and instead of trying to cram 2x25 onto a C90 with a very careful edit when the recap was over, and holding your breath until the last minute, and then the whole thing, the longer tapes would be much more likely to get chewed up by the tape player. So it probably, this one probably had a longer half-life than most of my audio recordings. So maybe that's why it stuck around so long.
Mm. There was one other thing I remembered about this one that I went back and investigated today, which was a slightly strange preview in Doctor Who Monthly, issue 75, as it turns out, which kind of gives you vibes of Time Meddler. Because at some point it has this weird line. A long time ago, didn't someone mention to me about jet airliners in 1320 AD? And then there was Shakespeare's Hamlet on television. Just a muddled memory? Or is there a grain of truth trying to break through? So, I don't know who wrote that preview or where they got that line from. It's certainly not from the story itself.
Hmm.
But yeah. And go on.
Printed as a line of dialogue.
It printed, the first part is printed as if it was a line of dialogue, and then the second thing is a comment on it.
Was that an era when, before they actually had access to genuine information about unbroadcast stories and just used to make it up?
I think J&T was giving information to Jeremy Bentham and others, but I mean whether that was just a case of somebody having misinterpreted what came through, I don't know. I mean, certainly stopping the Magna Carta feels more like a meddling monk plot than a master plot.
If only it was. If only it was a meddling monk story.
Yeah.
My biggest problem with it is not that it's out of character for the master or feels underwhelming as a master plot, but conversely, if it wasn't the master and was the meddling monk, that would fix some of my other problems because it would presumably be funny. and cohesive and have a reason to exist.
Hmm.
But, yeah, we didn't get that. So if only somebody would write that story about Hamlet being premiered on television.
Hmm.
That sounds like a good one.
Hmm.
I did it! It's an in-joke.
Well, as Capaldi says in the next one, premonition is just remembering backwards.
Has nobody got anything to say about it?
Well, I mean the other thing that I guess that I would say as a sort of opening gambit is that of all the historically ish stories, and there aren't many, I suppose, after Hartnell, this is the one that this one feels sort of similar-ish to the Crusade in the fact that it's a bit Shakespearean. There's sort of a bit more of that kind of
wishes.
Talking. Yes, it doesn't get anywhere close to it. It's not as good as Whitaker's efforts, but there's a lot of archaic language. I think it would be quite hard for a 6-year-old to follow.
Cringing caitiffs.
Mm.
I think it's used a couple of times.
There's something about this story that defies analysis to me. I just can't get hold of it because it bores me so much. I can't really tell whether it's good or bad dialogue. Well, it's not good dialogue, but I can't tell quite how bad it is. There's just something slippery about the way Terence Dudley writes. I didn't like his cod woodhousing stuff at the beginning of Black Orchid either, even though that was the best bit in it. I find him annoying when he's trying to pastiche other styles.
Mm.
But it's nowhere near as annoying as I find his attempts to write a plot. I just cannot get my head around what he thinks he's doing in these. He can't even make a plot that makes sense over two episodes, let alone any longer.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I thought episode one was quite good and intriguing until we get the sci-fi ending. I mean, there's a few mysteries going on. And I'm thinking, yeah, you know, I'm quite liking that. But then it's all a bit weird. You know, the big reveal is that Sajil is the master, which is kind of interesting to us and to the Doctor. But anyone else in the banqueting hall haven't got a clue what's going on, think.
Do they even see? That was something I was going to bring up.
Oh, go on then.
Do they even see that? I can't work out the way it's played.
Yeah.
Like, Tegan only apparently recognises the master because he's got a tissue compression eliminator.
Right.
Because she comments on that and realises it must be the master because of that. And everybody else doesn't... Nobody else seems to...
Right.
...blink an eye at the fact that he's changed his face.
Yeah.
Nobody else just seems to react at all.
Yes.
And then when the master presents himself...
Later on... Yes, exactly.
...to the gullible medieval misfits as... The man is going to, you know, they don't, nobody goes, hang on, but aren't you the guy that was in the...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, hang on, didn't you? Weren't you wearing a false moustache? And
yeah.
I mean, this is part of false moustache. I'm so bored that I keep drifting off for 20 seconds at a time and thinking, this makes no sense. Did I miss something really important or...
No.
Or was it just not there to be missed?
It would work nicely
if they did see it and then he... would be considered to be another demon, and because he presents himself as the opposite, as doesn't he almost present himself as an opposing demon who will rid,
yeah,
but a good one who will rid us of the bad demon that's been,
well, I mean, that would
been spooking the king.
That would,
right?
Be all so very well if they didn't know that he was already Sajil who had been spooking the king for the first episode.
Yeah,
but they appear to think he's Sajil, well, and see him as Sajil all the way until they put him in.
It can all work. He acts as Sajil's mysterious bodyguard, and so he could, when he's revealed, he could say, no, I was in disguise, I was protecting him, I've come from hell, this chap in the cricketing costume is a... I'm not saying this is a great story, but you could have tied it. If I was the script editor and it was too late,
yeah,
this is the night before recording, and it was too late to actually start again and make this something worthwhile, I think you could fix most of the little things that don't make sense, clarify them. That's not the only one. I've got another bad idea to make it marginally better later on. I'll keep that in reserve.
It's an odd one. I mean, from what I didn't read that there were any particular problems with script delivery on this. I mean, it was definitely done to it was done as a it was a shopping list story. Mm. Working title, The Android, which would definitely have given the game away. And, so supposedly the people who developed Chameleon knew Richard Gregory was working on effects stuff and he gave them an in. So they showed their working, you know, in development robot to JNC, who bought into the idea. So Terence Dudley got the job of writing in the robot as a new pseudo companion, and also was then asked to write a master story because they wanted to have, you know, they pre-contracted Ainley that he'd be in one story in season 20. This was obviously the one.
Hmm.
Yeah, and apparently the Magna Carta thing came from Terence Dudley. There'd been an idea he'd been knocking around previously a bit. But it doesn't feel like there was that much. I mean, apparently there weren't any great issues with that, but there were obviously huge ructions when it came to production with this. Forgive me if I'm rambling and if I'm telling you stuff that everyone already knows, but essentially there were strikes that meant they had to stop doing Enlightenment halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
I think they didn't record the second studio block of Enlightenment. That meant that, so it wasn't as simple as them cancelling Return of the Daleks or whatever it would have been called, the return at the end of the season. It was that they had to sacrifice that in order to finish Enlightenment.
Right.
And as it then turned out, they then hit all sorts of problems with this in the studio blocks, at least partly to, you know, because Chameleon wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And so they also had to do a remount of this as part of the presumably making use of the fact they'd saved some studio budget and time left over because they only had half of Enlightenment still left to record. So I think it was pretty chaotic in those terms, and then apparently fairly torrential rain and stuff on location didn't help with, you know, meant a lot of stuff got canned there. But yeah, it still doesn't make a lot of sense. And I'm trying to work out. I was trying to work out whether it's in the direction. Is it because it's Tony Virgo's first directing gig?
I mean, I felt like the exterior stuff was actually quite nice. You know, I mean, there's some nice angles in that.
Visually it's nice, but I just wonder about if it feels like someone's not ready for sense.
Hmm.
The actual. What, and
yeah, I wouldn't personally think that. I think it's a bit late once the director's come on board. But do you mean... No, carry on.
I'm just trying to work out whether it's the blocking or... I'm not sure. I wouldn't have the terminology, really. And the actors should be able to interpret. But the bit that really got to me... And sorry, I'm shanghaiing this slightly.
Yeah.
So there's the line that the Doctor gets his... gets knighted and made King's Champion, supposedly. Yeah. And the whole thing plays out. Your Majesty does me great honour. I'm reading this off the Chapatea transcript. Your Majesty does me great honour. My first action in this role shall be to arrest that man, arrest Sir Geoffrey de Lacy. And Geoffrey then has a side to Ranulph. The Doctor's next line is, unhand him, he's a man of honour. Lord Ranulph, is there a dungeon in this castle? Else, there it is. The Doctor then says, Sir Geoffrey, do you know it? Then be so good as to lead me to it. I must insist you lead me to the dungeon. And then he draws his sword to Geoffrey and says, you have no choice. Must I remind you that my sovereign lord holds the Lady Isabella hostage? And sorry, the transcript is also garbled here. I'm not entirely surprised. But anyway, so there's this very odd thing, and it feels like, apparently, there was, according to the production notes, there was a scripted wink from the Doctor to Ranulph trying to pull a fast one, which then wasn't recorded, it wasn't filmed, recorded. And it all feels to me like half of this dialogue is meant to be, you know, the whole thing is delivered, you know, like
stage front,
completely straight and completely out loud to everyone. It feels to me, as garbled as it is, like half of it is meant to be, this is the Doctor's face, and then half of it is the Doctor muttering under his breath.
Yeah.
We're trying to have a sotto conversation with them.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it feels like there's a whole layer of subtext there, or, you know, whatever.
It's interesting
even,
you
not
fix
even
on that
subtext,
scene.
But just...
It's interesting you fix on that scene, because that is the one where... Well, I remember thinking, have I missed a bit? What's going on? I thought I'd only drifted off for 5 seconds, and I couldn't work out what was happening. Mm. And your explanation for what we should have seen would go some way to fixing that. Hmm. Well, maybe you're right. Maybe the director. I mean, it's not great. It's not a great bit of writing. But if you again, having done that, having gone down that route. You absolutely need to show that. And
I'm reading it from the transcript, not from the script.
Why is it so wrong? Davison plays it very straight.
Yeah.
When he normally likes an opportunity to do anything a bit, the slightest bit different, doesn't he? So, but he's really playing that full pelt and makes it look like he's responsible for a lot of what happens afterwards by turning Frank Windsor and everybody... against him when he just about had them on side.
On side, yeah.
So, yeah, how odd. So this was John Virgo's first and only Doctor Who, was it?
I don't think he did any others. He go off to do...
I agree with things. Richard. There's some of the location stuff looks nice. I've made a note of one... which I'm going to throw in completely randomly because I want to say something nice about it. I like the
Tony
shot
Virgo,
when...
Tony Virgo, not John
Virgo. I know. It was hope was delivered.
Oh, it was delivered. Yeah. Okay, sorry. It went...
I like to amuse myself.
Yeah.
I like the shot in the immediate aftermath of... is Frank Windsor's son? Is it Hugh? Is his name Hugh? Or do I know? The one who's fighting the jewel on his
behalf. Yes, him, I think.
Falls to the ground, and then in the background we see... his opponent get off his horse, take off his armour piece by piece, walk slowly towards us like
very nice.
A Terminator or something, and draw his sword. That one shot was... Mm. It didn't make it all worthwhile.
Mm.
It meant that it isn't completely execrable.
Yeah. Only took 3 hours to film. It Sorry, go on.
Does...
well, it does... Oh, God, I can imagine.
Does give me flashbacks to the 80s reprint cover of The Crusaders, actually, as well.
Right.
You can see that. Knights on horseback outside the TARDIS. Are they on horseback in the Coupe? I'm imagining that now.
The thing is, aside from whether or not any of it makes any sense, I'm fighting a losing battle with this story because it's so full of all the stuff I don't like about, which mostly happens in this era of Who, really. I don't really like stories that get bogged down in the TARDIS lands. Our friends are immediately suspected. They get into a situation where they look suspicious. They're arrested. They have to constantly be on the back foot and say, "I didn't. I'm not."
Yeah.
And Turlough spends the entire story being accused of things and going, "I didn't do it."
Yeah.
Saying all things that you wouldn't say in those situations.
Yeah.
It's a wonder he doesn't show them. Officer shows them inside the TARDIS.
Well, I was going to say it's remarkably similar in structure, isn't it? To Black Orchid, in the sense that there's a first episode where stuff happens, and then a second episode where nothing really happens, but people start doing weird stuff, and technology seems to be the answer. Yeah,
I imagine any reason he doesn't is because they all think they're demons, they're supernatural beings anyway. So what difference would it make showing them the inside of the TARDIS? Otherwise, they probably would.
Yeah.
And they're all written at their worst. Tegan, who I love, is really whiny. This is the version of Tegan that people who don't like Tegan remember. The Doctor's trying to interest her in the plot, and she says, "Who cares?" Just like it's a famous maxim. Who was it, Russell, who says that you should never have a character saying, "I'm bored," because as soon as the character raises the specter of things being boring, the audience will start thinking. I mean, the companion should not be going around telling the Doctor, "Who cares? I don't care." It's just it's filler guff.
It's also one of these things where there's good chaps and bad chaps, you know, which isn't really, I guess, the experience of history, you know. So you've got, there's a lot of people being conspicuously English when you've got to feel that they're all Normans. And then so Sajil is sort of some kind of standout weirdo being French when, in fact, probably they're all speaking French at this sort of period.
Yes, yeah.
So you know, that, I mean, it's, you know, I suppose probably the standard of the films of the time, that probably it's fine. It's very kind of Robin Hood in that kind of way, but it's not, you know, particularly historically accurate. And then you've got, in amongst all of that, the Doctor sort of trying to be a bit sort of counter to normal history, saying, "Oh no, King John's a fine chap."
That's all very Terence Diggs, isn't it? Terence loved to defend.
Yeah.
Which
I'm not sure I don't think it stands up in quite the way that it's presented there. So, yeah. Anyway.
Anybody know anything about King John? Because I don't.
Well, his father's Henry II, right?
Yes.
And they're all French, and they spend most of their time in France. Now, John...
Well, he isn't French. He was born in Oxford.
Yeah, and in fairness, he probably spent more of his time in England than most of them.
Hmm.
Yeah. They're always fighting each other. I mean, until Henry II stands down in 1189, it's just one battle of the sons against another, really. And his wife was no different.
This is something we will never know quite how slow the transition from Norman to Anglo-Norman to English was.
Mm.
I mean, yes, they probably were speaking French, but I don't think they were French in any meaningful sense. I mean, if they were French, they wouldn't be fighting King Philip of France.
Because
they had most of their territories in France.
They're buried in the Loire. So, yeah.
Mm.
There's an abbey that I went to in the Loire where John and Richard and I think Henry II are all buried. So,
not according to the article I'm looking at. It says here I'm told he's buried in Worcester Cathedral.
Hmm.
Born Oxford, died Newark Castle, Nottinghamshire, buried Worcester.
He was buried in that castle then.
I mean, I'm not trying to defend the story, I'm just trying to attack you.
Well, France wasn't France in terms of, France wasn't, it didn't cover the geographically all of France as it is today.
They were the descendants of the original Anglo-Normans, ruling the Saxon peasantry, and
so
still speaking French for another century or so in court and in parliament.
Hmm.
But I think they, by this point, I would have thought they were more likely to think it sounds as English. But it's
You're right. It's only Henry II, Richard the Lionheart, and Eleanor Aquitaine who are buried in this place, Fontevraud. But Richard is the same generation as John. But for various reasons, John, he did spend more time in England than the others. Mm. But they generally, I think, saw the Loire as being more of the centre of operations.
I want to say something else irrelevant now. The only thing we all know about King John is Magna Carta, of course, which is also the only thing Terence Dudley knows about him. But I'd just like to throw in that if you've ever seen Shakespeare's King John, fairly sure it doesn't mention Magna Carta at all, which is an underexplored question of why. One theory is that it just wasn't as important at that point in history. It was only much later that we fetishized it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Indeed,
Hungarian peasant girl.
Shakespeare makes up most of Shakespeare's King John is some made up story about a bastard son.
Right.
Hmm.
It's a very strange one. It comes right in the middle of a run of good stuff either side of it.
Yeah,
And it's never performed. But if you want to watch it, watch the BBC version because it's got, I've forgotten his name there. Got something good in it.
We'll come back to that on the subject of Magna Carta. The master wants to destroy parliamentary democracy, apparently, according to the dialogue.
He does.
But I mean, if he just hung around for a few centuries, then Boris Johnson would have done it for him.
Satire. He doesn't even push that as far as he could do, because of course, in line with Magna Carta being a much bigger deal now than it was possibly in Shakespeare's time, unless he just didn't think it was very dramatic, it's often credited as being the foundation not just of our parochial English democracy, but many similar systems around the world claim it as its ancestor, don't they? So I suppose the master doesn't grandiloquently claim. Mm. If Terence Diggs was writing this, he would definitely claim that most of the universe, of the universe's ideas of democracy, come from this point, because he would love to believe that we British could lay claim to that.
Well, there is a marvellous stretch, isn't there, in the dialogue where the Master then says, with Chameleon's unique ability at my command, it's only a matter of time before I undermine the key civilizations of the universe.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Is he implying that this one act
will
have ripple effects, which would be interesting? You could argue it. It wouldn't bear too close scrutiny, but you could argue it and get away with it. Or is he saying that he will go off with Chameleon around the universe and do the same trick millions of times, which would be the long way around?
I kind of assume the latter, that this is kind of a dress rehearsal, which is why it's... Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's rubbish. Everyone's being charitable. That's the worst of both worlds. That's the worst of both worlds, because it means that you had it right there. You could have hoodwinked us into believing that this moment was going to ripple out across the universe, and that would... You know, the kids would have gone with that. But... to believe that he's going to have to go on and do this same trick everywhere else is kind of asinine. And, you know, it ties into the flaw that everyone picks up on, that why is he, one minute he's literally got the universe at his feet with his, whatever he's doing in Legopolis, you know, the master. Yeah. And next minute he's fiddling with some fairly small scale English bureaucracy. And if... you could take that off in a different direction, that Chameleon is what he wants. There's another version of this story where Chameleon is here and the Master didn't bring him here, and it's Chameleon's what he wants, and then you could end up with that fight over Chameleon as between him and the Doctor. It could end it in the same way.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't have to suffer through the idea that...
He
was sitting away in disguise for no reason whatsoever, of course. But that's hardly the first time.
Well, I mean, he would have got away with it, the Master, if it hadn't been for that Tegan ex machina ending, where she arrives at just the right moment.
Yes, yeah.
Yes, that's one of the lamest endings I've ever seen. It took me by surprise.
It's very odd.
I wasn't looking at my watch. And it, I couldn't believe it actually finished. I thought there must be another scene that they were going to get once he ran into the TARDIS. I thought, well, what we're going to do next is they got one final clever trick. But no, it just takes the Master's, the rogue, the android, away and
assume he's going to be happy to, and apparently he is, because we then get a 2-second cutaway to him sidling off into his TARDIS.
So
odd. Just to be Captain Fact,
go on.
Just to be Captain Fact Check, Leonard Rossiter.
Thank you.
Is King John in the BBC version.
I told you it was worth watching.
Yeah, sounds like it.
He makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah. Yes. So it was actually John who lost mainland Normandy, because there were the Dukes of Normandy up until and indeed beyond John, but John lost Normandy in 1204. So before this, he'd already lost it to King Philip of France.
Yep. But they kept their claim
for 55 years officially, and then obviously kept banging on about it for another couple of hundred years afterwards, trying to get it back. But yes. But what was that? Oh, that was apropos of the accents and things. But I can't work it out. I mean, my only two comments, and they're not really coherent, is one is it a bit like hello, hello, treatment of the accents.
Yeah.
But one is meant to assume there's an accent everywhere where, although in hello, hello, everyone puts on an accent except they all put on accents and then can't make themselves understood if they speak in the accent.
Yes,
is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, good moaning. And frankly, I think Amy went to the same. Yeah, it's the Arthur Bostrom School of French linguistics. Officer Crabtree, I was pissing by your castle, and my only other thought would be that the universal translator circuits on the TARDIS clearly can't quite cope with. Can't cope with another Time Lord putting on a hammy accent.
Maybe he's impervious to telepathy.
Yes. You know, this is His Majesty. You insult the king. Poof.
I mean, that bit, you know, with the sword fight and everything. I mean, it's a bit of a slow sword fight, but and actually the whole set of the Great Hall. It's quite, it's pretty good.
The banquet, yeah. That's the thing. I don't have any problem with that side of it. I think it's not a bad production in terms of it looks like what you'd expect. It doesn't look particularly bad. It's of a standard with other TV historical productions of the of that sort of period. Yeah, my doubt is just like it just feels like someone didn't go through it and actually try and make sense of what is being said and.
What
is in the dialogue and how?
It would explain a lot. Mm. I've got a note here which I missed, I should have mentioned ages ago. When I think this links into the scene that you, or maybe I'm an idiot. Why does the Doctor carry on talking to the King after the Master is revealed as if he's the real King? He was already suspicious of him before the Master business, and then this is the point at which the story should turn, but he carries on indulging him. So am I missing something, or does it link into what you were saying about where he's playing up to him and winking to Frank Windsor?
Yes, he sort of allows himself to be knighted, doesn't he?
I mean, it must be. I must be referring to the scene immediately before.
Yes,
before that. This is after, presumably, after the fight, after the Master's been put in his Iron Lady, whatever called Iron Maiden. Not an effigy of Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, and then he gets made his champion.
Well, it must be.
But it's just before
that.
But yes.
I should have made a note of exactly.
I think you're right.
But it's all part of the part and parcel of the same problem. Yeah. I can't understand people's motivations. It's a short story and not very complicated, so it should be much. Yeah. It shouldn't be possible to be this confused by it. But it's when you're confused and bored at the same time that. As I check out, I'm afraid.
I suppose you could be perhaps trying to work out what's going to happen with the King now that Sir Gilles has gone, because he's got to imagine that the Master has been behind some of this stuff.
Well, quite. It's a bit of a coincidence.
Yeah.
He's thinking what's wrong with the King.
Yes.
He's either been taken over or it isn't the real King.
Yeah.
I can't remember if at that point...
He knows it's not the real King.
Right. And then the Master appears. So why doesn't he push things to her?
Yeah.
Because there's still an episode to go.
You would have thought that he and Ranulf together could do something at that point. You're right.
Maybe he's being political.
It's before the reveal of Chameleon in his true form, and he knows it's...
Yeah.
He knows the Master's up to something else. Yeah.
So I guess that's... I guess he's playing a long game, and that's why he does what he does in a very unclear way. To get closer to the King, so he can investigate. Do you think it was written without Turlough in mind, because he gets nothing to do?
Yeah.
Although, no.
Bit of Agnissa to worry about, even if it.
Yeah.
Even if it was an earlier.
I mean, he's in his own strand, so I suppose you couldn't really have inserted that entire plot strand. I don't care.
I quite like the. I mean, so the reveal of Chameleon. If it had been done in a more interesting story, it's sort of like the reveal of the record player, I suppose, in the Time Meddler. It's that sort of similar sort of thing. It's completely completely unexpected. I think it's completely unexpected at that point. So yeah,
the record player.
I guess when you know that twist is coming, it's kind of hard to see it in the same way.
The reason it's not as good is because we know there's something funny
about
the King. The reveal of exact... And we've been thinking about it for an episode and a half. So that by the time we actually get the reveal, it's, oh, I see, that's one of the... It might even be something you'd thought of. You know, it's going to be something like that because you're watching Doctor Who. So a much better twist would have been to a bit of misdirection. Like, sort of Moffat style, you write like you're a magician. You make the audience look over there, think something else is right. You don't make them suspicious of the King.
Yeah.
You make them suspicious of somebody else, maybe Sir Gilles or what, I don't know.
Yes.
And then, ha-ha! You weren't looking here. It's actually King John isn't himself. But he acts weird from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Why didn't everyone walk in and say, King John was... 5'5", stocky and red-headed. He didn't look like this. That should have been a hell of a giveaway. Never mind, he's in London. Yes, I am looking at Wikipedia.
Yeah. Yes, and you are. Yeah. And in the Moffat vein, you were you spend the entire season insisting that it's not going to be an Android duplicate or anything lame like that.
Oh, God.
Have we wrung everything out of this? Is there other stuff you want to talk about?
Well, the only other thing I wanted to, the only other point that I wanted to make when we talk about all that, you know, this sort of weird lack of interpretation of the script is that apparently, I did note that apparently both Amy and Davidson were skipping rehearsals on this because they were going down to Tunbridge Wells and playing in a J&T Cinderella production.
Right.
When they frankly should have been rehearsing right. on the BBC's dime. So I do, it does weirdly. And
explains a lot.
Unfortunately, I didn't have time to see any, to look at any behind the scenes material or anything and see if anyone had any particular recollections.
It seemed quite familiar to me, and not in a good way, because I watched all the extras from the season 20 Blu-ray not that long ago. Yeah. So I mean, because it's so short, you get proportionately a lot more of it in the behind the sofa stuff.
Oh, of course.
So I've watched them all fairly recently.
Yeah.
Being nonplussed, but I don't remember any of them being as, I don't remember Davidson being as vitriolic as he is. Black Hawk, for example.
No, but, I recall.
Bloody well should.
I mean, Frank Winter seemed to quite enjoy it, and Isla Blair was talking about trying not to laugh in the death scene with the Sir What's His Face.
Oh yes, yeah.
Sir Geoffrey. So there were some nice anecdotes. I mean, the weirdest thing though is that it's a beautiful castle with a moat, and for some bizarre reason they don't show the moat in this film. You thought that would, it's the one thing you would draw attention to because that's what you expect to have around the castle.
And which castle is it? Is it the one near me?
Apparently it's
Odium.
Bodium,
yes. I say near me. I mean, you know, I'm claiming it as nearish. It's just across the border, I think.
Yeah. Apparently it was set in Odium Castle. And then they filmed it in Bodium Castle. So there you go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, it's got all these good actors in, and I think the script is actor-proof in the wrong way. I don't think you can make it good, no matter how good you are. The only actor I really like is the bloke plays Sir Geoffrey, who's not... Yeah. I just checked, he's not a name. But he's playing it... In any other story, I'd probably think, oh, you're underplaying it a bit, you're spoiling it. But in this one, I actually believe him, and I don't believe any of the others, even though they're doing, I suppose... good work. I'm not entirely sure I want to include Gerald Flood in that because I think he's having too much fun. Yeah. It's not fruity enough.
Yes.
I think the dialogue needs and the characters need to be fruitier to justify the performance that the rest of the cast want to give. Mm. And I'm sure they're doing it for the best of reasons, but
yeah,
it might actually work better if it had been played a bit more down to earth. Mm. Anyway, whatever. Too late now.
Yeah, I was going to confess that I didn't spot Ainley in this one when I was 15. I thought this French guy. I wonder what's going on with him. And then when he changed into the master, I was he could have knocked me over with a feather.
I can't remember. I honestly can't.
I can't remember either. No.
Yeah. And Tegan's got a nice new dress. But it must have been in the TARDIS laundry during the Five Doctors, because then it reappears for Warriors of the Deep.
Yes, it is that one, isn't it?
And
And
not for Antios.
Mm. No. And would it have been on the Blu-ray that where I saw her explaining how her costume evolved in the story, that it was so cold on location that she had to grab that thing, that strange rug, and then it became part of the continuity. That she had to pick it up in the TARDIS when they got back to the studio and keep it on.
Mm.
And presumably all that dialogue about, are you warming up yet, Tegan, all the way through? It's just to keep that thread going.
Yeah.
Just to justify not getting hypothermia during the jousting. Well, there you go. That's what happens if you get Tombstone to write your scripts and a snooker player to direct them.
Yeah.
Well, and sadly, just to finish off on the sad saga of a comedian. I didn't realise, but one of the two guys, basically two engineers that built it and designed it, and one of whom was doing the mechanical side of it, and the other was doing the software side of it and the voice syncing and everything like that. and the software engineer was killed in a boating accident before they went into production, which left them floundering to, you know, then it sort of put everything onto the other guy who didn't really know, which is why it never really worked.
I'm surprised you didn't know that. I thought that was one of the most famous chameleon facts.
I honestly didn't. I knew it had had problems, but I didn't know that was what. That was the sort of behind-the-scenes story.
But it's weird, isn't it, that, you know, in Star Wars, you get a bloke inside a suit and that's perfectly fine for everyone. But for some reason in Doctor Who, they want to have a robot that's actually a robot. Anyway, there we go.
Yeah, you do wonder why there wasn't any sort of cutting their losses.
Yeah,
and that even when they took it with them, even though by that point they pretty much knew they weren't going to be using it. On, you know, it would have a couple of appearances, but no more.
Yeah, they could easily. They wouldn't have even had to cut that scene. There's plenty of stories in this era which end with somebody else in the TARDIS who's not there at the beginning of the next week.
Whether it's, well, that's true. Like, yeah,
the young lad at the end of the awakening. Yeah. You know, happens a lot. It's
It
would have started with some dialogue.
Yeah. Yes. Sounds an evil brew.
Yep. Just like this starts. They arrive at Bodiam Castle. Yeah. They see nothing particularly suspicious outside, and Tegan says, could it be a Black Guardian? What the hell is she talking about? She's insane.
That's classic.
Anything that actually made me laugh. Yeah.
It's that classic Davison era thing, isn't it, though?
Yeah.
They're always like, here, have a crowbarred in reference to the last story.
Yeah.
From memory, I think that terrible bit of dialogue is satirized in a big finish. they set approximately 10,000 stories between Enlightenment and the King's Demons in an old Anissa trilogy, but that's by the by. In what in Big Finish continuity is the immediate follow-on from Enlightenment. They're Cobwebs by Johnny Morris. They arrive somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Something fairly mundane happens, and Tegan says, could this be the Black Guardian? And the Doctor says, as sarcastically as the Fifth Doctor's ever been, oh yes, Tegan, that's exactly the kind of thing he'd do. Which I just urge you all to go out and listen to that if you haven't.
Oddly enough, this story, they weren't content with it going out in March. They decided to repeat it again in July of the same year. Oh, no, it's the following year. Okay, so it's a little bit of a distance. But yeah, you'd wonder why you would pick this one to repeat of all the possibilities, unless they only had two slots for 50 minutes, maybe.
Must be, wasn't it? What did they repeat the next year?
I can't give you that. I've only got this information.
I looked at all the repeats recently when I wrote an article for everyone's favourite fanzine, Warp Warp, about repeat seasons in the 80s. It was mostly about the Five Faces of Doctor Who and
But they did have some nice ones in the summers, didn't they?
About the rest of the, I tried to cram in information about the rest of the decade, and then my main point was just how disappointing, how quickly it returned to initially to normal after the Five Faces of Doctor Who and then to nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, we get the massive Five Faces, then the quite good Doctor and the Monsters, but it's less of it, and then after that it's just a couple of stories in the previous season, and then it's nothing. Yeah. Bad luck. You missed it. Tough shit. Great days. Kids, you don't know you're born. Yeah. You can get this stuff at the press of a button now. Yeah. A button. Can you imagine? Back in my day, buttons didn't show you television programs. Yeah. They just fastened your clothing. And now look.
Yeah.
I don't know what they do. I'm starting to get a bit overexcited.
I think we should probably take a break. Do you want to get a cup of tea or something? We'll come back and talk about the t'other one.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Closing thought, they spent £500 on wigs for this.
Well, I tell you what, they were robbed with Ainley's wig.
There's the kind of facts.
Well, I mean, but he already had a wig.
Well, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Do you think that's why they did it? Why they kept him in disguise?
Wig on top of a wig. Story,
just to tease him, so that he would, to force him to wear the wig on top of his other wig, and just try and break him. If we keep doing this one day, he's going to take this thing off and put this one on in its place, rather than stacking them up like pancakes.
Oh, the wig, a wig on top, off top of a wig on top of a wig would be the one to go for, wouldn't it?
Oh, you know. Okay. It's a wonder they didn't deliberately write a story with the master meeting Nida just to, see what happened.
Brilliant. Okay.
Yeah.
Back in a sec.
Time for break. That's the badger.
That's, I hope, the one. Bro, were you okay with that? It sounded lovely to me, but I could only hear myself.
Well, it's ironic that we've chosen to do this, you know, the episode after we had Jess on. On the other hand, he'd probably have run away screaming and...
Yes. Well, there we go. Here's a clip from my other podcast. Hello and welcome to If It's Hurting, It's Not Working, our podcast all about work, how we work, why we work, and what makes a great job. This time, we're going to discuss a fascinating topic, artificial intelligence and its impact on our lives and careers. Hi, Em, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Hi there, nice to be back. It's been a while.
And also joining us is our other co-host, Nicola. How are you doing?
Yes, very well, thank you.
And our guest tonight is someone that we've all worked with and yet somehow has never appeared on this podcast before. It's Viv Leinster.
I'm a people, culture and transformation leader. I've worked in a variety of sectors, not least our previous employer. It seems that I had to leave in order to get invited to this podcast, so I'm delighted to be here.
I think it's quite funny in a way that people think of AI as a recent development, because I first became aware of the subject back in the late 80s when I was studying engineering at Cambridge. So if we fast forward 35 years, and what's really changed things lately is generative AI, and in particular tools like ChatGPT.
What's changed from 35 years ago is the rate of change. So it's the accelerated nature now, I think, of what we are seeing and what AI is capable of. And there's a positive or a dark side and a light side, I think, to AI. And as a co-pilot, you know, to the work that we do, it can be great. If it's doing the jobs that we hate doing, then it's great. But if it's taking over the jobs or the tasks that we love doing,
yeah,
then suddenly it feels a little bit different.
Em, you got thoughts about AI and whether it's coming after your job?
I don't think it's coming after my job, because you can never take away the emotional intelligence, right? AI is not going to be able to do that side of my job. It's got lots of good uses, particularly for myself with dyslexia. I find the minute-taking functionality fantastic. That's something that takes up a lot of time.
Sort of on first impressions, it's incredibly powerful and useful in aspects of the workplace, but I don't think it would be able to take over my job holistically. Are you with us now, Emily?
We do sign language if necessary. I think I know what that means.
Yeah. International sign language.
Yeah.